This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Florida school shooting that killed 17 people last week has dominated the news this week and has rekindled the gun control debate. Today, Florida lawmakers said they want to arm trained teachers, and that's an idea that President Trump supports.
A gun-free zone to a killer or somebody that wants to be a killer, that's like going in for the ice cream. That's like, here I am, take me. We have to get smart on gun-free zones.
Earlier today, Florida's Republican governor proposed raising the age at which someone can buy firearms. Students from Florida and around the country are mobilizing. They're calling for tough action on gun control. Here's Tyra Hemans, a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida.
In 1999, when Columbine happened, why does it have to happen 18 years later at my school? My friends are dead. No more!
We also spoke with Rachel Pryke this week. She's a senior at Acton Boxborough High School, and we talked with her about why students here in Massachusetts will be joining in the nationwide demonstrations.
The fact that the amount of people that are dying still isn't changing people's minds on gun regulation shows that we really need to show that students aren't safe anymore and that we have a right to education without having to fear for our lives.
So what's the way forward on guns after Parkland? Joining me in the studio to talk about this and other news this week are Tom Keene. He's a former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Hi there.
Pleasure to be here.
Also, Jennifer Nasur is the former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party and currently with Reuben and Rudman. Is that
yes,
correct?
That
also
is correct.
Founder and president of Conservative Women for a Better Future. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We do want to note at the start that you're working with former aide to former Governor Mitt Romney and now Republican U.S. Senate hopeful Beth Lindstrom, and you're in a non-paid position.
Correct,
as
I am.
Finance
yes.
chair. Okay, so let's go to guns, which have been in the news all week, and of course this plan to potentially arm some teachers, which I want to say we talked about on the show this week and got an awful lot of strong reactions from folks to this plan. First, let's hear a little bit of President Trump talking about this proposal to the Conservative Political Action Conference. He spoke about it again today, as he has during this week, and he argues that teachers with firearm experience should use concealed carry laws to have guns in school. He says maybe 40% of teachers, maybe they should get a pay boost. Let's listen to what he said today.
The beauty is it's concealed. Nobody would ever see it unless they needed it. It's concealed. So this crazy man who walked in wouldn't even know who it is that has it. That's good. It's not bad. That's good. And a teacher would have shot the hell out of him before he knew what happened.
And yesterday on our show, we heard from Lisa Graustein, a teacher in Boston for the last 20 years. She's currently at the Codman Academy Charter Public School in Dorchester. Here's what she told us.
In the event of an active shooter in a school, it means I would have to be near the active shooter, I would be prevented from protecting my students, and I would also have to be a good enough shot to take that person out. Most of us became teachers because we care about young people and we want to teach them. I'm really good at teaching reading, writing, and history. I did not go into the military or the police force because that's not where I'm called and that's not where my skill set lines.
Okay, big debate among teachers about this proposal to potentially arm some teachers in an effort to improve school safety. I want to ask both of our guests about this plan. Tom, your thoughts on this as a way to improve school safety?
I think it's a really terrible idea. I mean, even in the states that now have concealed carry laws, you don't really see people being able to pull out their guns and somehow, you know, take down someone who may be an active shooter. Trying to deputize, you know, teachers who really should be focusing on other things is really trying to create an environment within a school that is one of fear. There's a lot of other approaches you can take, gun control certainly being one of them. The other would be much better screening in terms of what's going on with mental health and really starting to identify the signs, usually suicidal thoughts, that indicate that someone could potentially become an active shooter.
Mm. Jennifer, your thoughts?
I'm exactly where Tom is. I have kids that are in elementary school and middle school, and I wouldn't want their teachers to be walking around with firearms. I have friends that are teachers, and one of my best friends taught from South Central LA to Bronx to a school in Hartford now, and the stories that she tells me about these kids, I think if you're a teacher in those situations, you also run the risk that a kid could take the gun from you. Mm. And so I don't think the answer and the solution are more guns. I think it's less guns.
Mm. You know, though, I think it's very controversial. I think most teachers have said publicly they don't want it. The teachers' unions say that they do not support this. Governor Baker told reporters yesterday he does not support this. But then I read a Newsweek article that said that a sheriff in Ohio opened a concealed carry class to educators, and he first thought he'd get about 50 people. Well, he had to cap it at 300 because so many teachers were concerned about their own safety and protecting their students. So, you know, sometimes unpopular opinions are not widely spread publicly. So maybe there might be some educators here in this progressive, quote unquote, state of Massachusetts who don't want to admit that they support this. But there may be teachers who feel that way. You know, what?
Well, I have no, it doesn't surprise me that educators and others might want to learn how to hold a gun, how to use a gun, and so on. The question is, would it end up being effective in the circumstance we described? They have a handgun, a concealed handgun. Someone comes in, you know, with a semi-automatic, with a machine gun, can wipe out that teacher and everybody else. It really calls for the person to be able to aim that gun in a very harrowing circumstance, make sure you're going to hit the shooter rather than the dozens of other students around that shooter. It doesn't argue persuasively that this is the way to reduce school shootings. It may make some of the teachers feel safer, but I don't think it's going to reduce school shootings.
And maybe the way to go, I mean, you know, of course, this is an argument that I think needs to go on and on and on, and Congress needs to figure it out, and state houses need to figure it out. But I mean, you know, if you look at what marshals on airplanes did after September 11th, right? You don't know who the marshal is. There's a marshal there. Not that we should be putting marshals in schools. However, you know, if there is a gym teacher, if there is a coach who wants to be that person, maybe that's different than the teacher who's watching over 30 or 40 kids in a classroom. But, you know, I don't think there's any one perfect solution. I do think mental health in this country has really gone down the tubes over the past 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. When they started closing mental institutions and you started having less interaction with people figuring out who the mentally ill are and what spectrum that they're in. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably the biggest problem that we're facing right now.
Well, what if we don't talk about arming teachers? Let's talk a little bit about what the National Rifle Association CEO Wayne LaPierre said yesterday at the Conservative Political Action Conference. He urged communities to come together, and he said, you know, maybe not teachers, but maybe armed security guards. Let's harden our schools, he said. Let's listen.
They all must come together to implement the very best strategy to harden their schools, including effective, trained, armed security that will absolutely protect every innocent child in this country.
So, Jennifer, maybe not armed teachers, but do we need more guns to protect schools, or what do we need to protect schools?
So, as a parent, I don't think our schools need to be hardened. I'm actually offended by the fact that he used that word hardened, because I want my kids to feel safe and I want them to feel comfortable and secure, and making their everyday environment where they spend 8 to 10 hours hardened sounds a little bit more like prison than it does elementary school or middle school or high school. The security guard, look, the security guard that was there at Parkland did not go into the mm-hmm. school.
And
he was
resigned.
Armed.
It was already hardened. That's the point.
It was already hardened. He didn't go in the school. He didn't do anything. He wasn't effective. And thank God he resigned, because I think everyone would have been calling for his head. So I don't know if that actually works, right? I mean, talk about metal detectors, talk about other things, but I don't know if the security guard thing, if you're a security guard and you're going to run away from the fire, that's like a captain jumping ship.
Right. But so what do we do? Okay, here's the question. It was obviously not well handled in Florida. So what do we do? Tom?
I think two things. The one thing I think we actually can perhaps accomplish is better mental health screening. There's a lot of information, a lot of data out there that suggests that if you start to screen people find people who are particularly suicidal thoughts that you can start to divert them, start to address their issues. Clearly, in this case, you had an individual who any decent mental health system would have caught multiple times over and did not. And there were, in fact, it also speaks to the system really breaking down itself. The FBI and local law enforcement were very aware of the fact that this kid posed a danger. The second, which unfortunately I don't think is going to happen, would be some better measures at gun control. And I think you just hear it from the NRA and the Conservative Political Action Committee there. You're not going to really see that happen, notwithstanding the fact that you have a very motivated group of young people who are really pushing that idea right now and certainly changing the dynamic. Unfortunately, I think the waters are sufficiently muddied that you can point to law enforcement, you can point to mental health, and say it's really not the guns problem.
Red flag legislation we also talked about this week, which would allow people, if someone was determined to be dangerous, their guns could get taken away. Good idea?
Yeah, I think it is a good idea. And look, in an age of social media, right, where we all may not be trolling it all the time, but I know my kids are. They know what's going on with everyone in their circles. Not only everyone in their circles, people in, you know, 15 times removed, they know what's going on. Maybe it is fixing the mental health system, red flagging, seeing that there's this kid had dead animals and pictures of guns on social media. No one picked that up. He had two parents that died, caretakers that passed away. Like, that's actually something that impacts a kid that maybe they should have been picking up on, right? And so I think that, along with not selling these weapons to 18-year-olds and raising the age to 21, kids can't drink until they're 21. Maybe don't sell them firearms until they're 21.
They can't have a beer, but they can shoot. It's unbelievable.
So should we ban assault rifles? Jennifer?
I don't personally see the need for them. However, I understand in parts of the country it is sport. I know friends that do it, and I have shot it before, and it's...
You've shot an AR-15.
I have, and it's exciting. At a gun club, and it was exciting, and it was fun, but I don't have any mental issues. Well, my kids might say other things, but I don't have any mental issues. And that gun was someone else's, and they had it in a locker at the gun club, right? I don't see a need for it. Living in the city of Boston, I don't see a need for it in schools. I don't see why you would sell that type of machinery to anyone who's not in the military.
So we should ban them.
Personally, as a parent, yes, I think we should ban them. Mm-hmm. But I do understand. I do understand the perspective of Goal and the NRA that, you know, people want them in their sport. I personally don't see the need for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm just talking from a policy perspective. What do we do?
I mean, the past two shootings have been assault rifles, right? So you look at what has the destruction that they have caused, the lives that they have impacted, the families that they've impacted, the young people that have been taken off of this planet because of them. It makes a compelling argument.
Well, there was a very compelling argument about this very topic that we have a little bit of a clip of that I'd like to play right now. CNN held a town hall this week with students and families affected by the shooting, and Senator Marco Rubio spoke with some of those in attendance. And this is Rubio and Frank Gutenberg. His daughter was killed in the Parkland shooting, and Fred Gutenberg. And Gutenberg asked Senator Rubio about an assault weapons ban. Let's listen.
If I believed that law would have prevented this from happening, I would support it. But I want to explain to you why it would not.
Senator Rubio, my daughter, running down the hallway at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, was shot in the back.
Yes, sir.
With an assault weapon.
Yes, sir.
Okay? It is too easy to get. It is a weapon of war. The fact that you can't stand with everybody in this building and say that, I'm sorry.
So, Tom, with emotions like that, do you think we might see an assault weapons ban?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah, I really don't. I mean, I think you see, I have to tell you, I give Rubio an enormous amount of credit for showing up at that town hall and standing up and speaking. That he was vastly more courageous than a lot of others. But you still see him saying he's not going to do that. And I just don't see the dynamic at this point. I think what Rubio is probably would be arguing there is that if it wasn't that particular gun, it would have been some other gun, and that the issue was the mental health of the shooter. And I think that that plus the fact that we missed all of these warning signs sufficiently muddies the water that folks are going to be able to point in that direction rather than to guns per se.
Hmm. You know, as we said, Florida's governor did today. Republican governor did propose raising the age to buy a firearm. And here in the Northeast, four states have teamed up to share information about the origin of guns used in crimes. They've decided to coordinate gun violence research. New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. Do you think Massachusetts should join this group, Jennifer?
Governor Baker has said that, you know, has made a lot of comments on this in the past couple of days, and mm-hmm. it might be something. I don't know what the governor wants to do. I can't speak for him or his administration, but I mean, you know, it's interesting, and he has a good relationship with the governor of Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's something that he joins into. But Massachusetts has very, very strict gun laws right now, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, probably the strictest in the nation, and so. Whether we need to join in that to make any more of a statement, or we could just stand on our own as a state that shows that gun violence is down in Massachusetts and, you know, we're a model amongst other things, that could be it too.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Tom?
I think joining in with the other states is a great idea, but it is in fact true. Massachusetts is kind of in the forefront in terms of gun control. Mm-hmm. And you really do see that in terms of the reduction in the number of gun incidents in the state.
Right. Now, you mentioned, Tom, the student activists. And we also had some students on our show this week as well. They're planning and organizing all sorts of events. March 14th, a nationwide walkout. March 24th, March for Our Lives. That's happening in several cities around the country, including here in Boston. Another on April 20th. I mean, we've got a lot of things going on, and we've seen really powerful. These kids are powerful. Is this youth activism changing the debate or going to change the debate? I mean, Tom, you seem like pretty pessimistic about the outcome.
I am pessimistic about the outcome. I do think it's changing the debate. Look, the standard thing is this just gets put into partisan terms. The Democrats want to take away our guns. The Republicans want to keep mm-hmm. our guns. And it just becomes politicized so quickly. The kids have really introduced a very different dynamic. They're the ones being threatened here. And it is a really exciting voice. And it does add clearly something very dramatic to this conversation. As I said, unfortunately, I think the end result is going to be that you'll see movement perhaps in some other areas, but I don't think you're going to see movement in terms of, say, assault weapons being banned. Mm.
Do you think the youth activism here, Jennifer, is going to change any outcome?
You know, I was reading an interesting article that said, is this a moment versus a movement, or a movement versus a moment? Mm-hmm. And I agree with Tom. I think, you know, I love it. Anytime anyone wants to show activism on any issue, I think as someone who's been in politics my whole life, I think that it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. These young people, the ones that were speaking with the president the other day, 16, 17 years old, they're budding voters. And that's a great thing to take with them into that age group that normally doesn't vote. And so maybe that's where you see the change later on. I think right now it will probably turn from a movement into a moment, and then it will be up to them as young voters to have their voices be heard as they get older.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing interesting. Every other time we've had a mass shooting, people say, well, now's not the time to talk about gun control, as if we have to wait until the memories have faded, and then, of course, no one cares about talking about gun control anyway. These kids have really changed that dynamic. They're talking about gun control at the right time to talk about gun control.
Mm. Okay, we're going to move on a little bit. We have to talk about something that we've also talked about lots of times before, and this is the MBTA, again, facing criticism. This week, after the Red Line service was interrupted for 7.5 hours on Wednesday, and these delays were because of a train motor failure and a derailed train at Andrews Station and a stretch of damaged track. Now nobody was hurt, but morning commuters did describe the scene as a nightmare. This is T passenger Ayanna Myers, who spoke with NECN. Let's listen.
I don't understand why we're paying all these monthly fees that are almost close to $100 for this to happen and for me to take more than an hour just to get back to my house. It's ridiculous, especially for the handicap.
Yeah, 50 shuttle buses replaced the T on Wednesday, but even that wasn't enough. Here's Dan Gurley of Marshfield, who is waiting for a bus.
The crowd keeps pushing us this way.
Yeah.
They keep loading the buses at that end, so we don't get on a bus, and we've been standing here for a long time. We're getting a raw end of the deal here.
So, Tom, even in 70-degree weather, this happens to the T, and it's just, it was really pretty an unbelievable public relations disaster for the MBTA.
Yeah, so my daughter was stuck in that mess.
Oh, really?
And do you know what she did? She took an Uber. And and there's part of me that thinks that all of this is a conspiracy by Uber and Lyft to get customers. And I'm very, very seriously, what this does is persuade particularly millennials and now the upcoming Generation Z that Uber and Lyft and other services like that are the way to go. And they look at the convenience of it, the on-time performance, and the price, which is starting to get remarkably close to the price of the T, particularly if you do something like an Uber pool, and they're just jumping ship. They don't want to be taking public transit anymore.
Right, right. So this is yet another stain on public transportation. But what about the governor? You know, the governor has certainly said that he was going to improve the T, and this was a big goal of his. And he said that this incident is not acceptable. But Jennifer, thoughts here on this as a political liability, potential political liability for Charlie Baker?
I don't think it's a potential political liability. I mean, look, those rail tracks and everything, the whole system is more than 50 years old. It's been neglected for decades. This isn't Charlie Baker neglecting it. Charlie Baker and his administration has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to try to fix the T. But, you know, just like anything else, if you let it go and you don't take care of it, it's a lot harder to fix it. It's only been 4 years. Not even 4 years that he's been governor. And so, you know, it's going to take some time to fix. This is a generational thing. This is not an overnight. Rome wasn't built in a day thing.
Yeah, but, you know, we've heard that for an awful long time, not just from Charlie Baker, or from a lot of people who have been in power. Do you think, Tom, that this could be a potential political liability for Charlie Baker?
So it will be discussed politically, obviously, in the upcoming race.
So people will use it against him.
Right. People will try to use it against him. Do I think that it moves a lot of votes? No, I don't think it does. In part because of what Jennifer said, which is that it is a longstanding issue. Nevertheless, we always blame the guy in front of us. So we're going to blame, you know, the governor for this. But the other thing is that the political dynamic here is one that is echoed in other jurisdictions. Washington, D.C., for example, has this bright, shiny metro system that is literally killing people as it's falling apart. And it's like a $500 billion fix is now being talked about amongst Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. They have done exactly the same thing we did, which is not invest the money to maintain the system. And as a result, it is now falling apart. And you can see this across the country. So the phenomenon is one that I think is less about the governor or whoever is the presiding officer, and the fact that legislators and taxpayers in general don't want to pour money into something like this. They'll keep it operating, but they don't want to spend the capital dollars necessary to keep it really in tune.
So maybe Uber after all.
Well, maybe Uber, and it may in fact be the future anyway.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about a story related to Governor Baker. This week, the Mass GOP scrapped a rule on political organizing around the state gubernatorial primary. So essentially, Scott Lively, who's a pastor who has made some controversial statements, including anti-LGBT statements and other things, he requested that the party help him collect 10,000 voter signatures to qualify for the September primary against Charlie Baker. But with the repeal of that rule, the Mass GOP does not have to give any material support to Lively. So we spoke with Jim Rappaport. He's former chairman of the Mass GOP and current chairman of Fiscal Partner. And he agrees with the party's decision to repeal that rule. Here's what he said about Lively.
He has absolutely every right to go out and get the signatures. He has absolutely every right to try to get the 15% of the convention delegates to go to the primary in order to get onto the primary. he has no right to expect that the party apparatus is going to help him do that.
So, Jennifer, you used to lead the Mass GOP. What do you think?
I mean, I couldn't agree more with Jim Rappaport. It was as a former party chair, we all do the same thing, right? You say, okay, look, I can help you to what extent I can help you, or I don't have to help you. And by the way, we're the Republican Party. This is the party of teach a man to fish, and I'm not giving you any handouts. And Scott Lively can go out there. He can go get the 10,000 signatures. He could go organize his grassroots. He can get his 15% at the convention, just like every other candidate is doing right now. And he doesn't have to look to the party for support. So the fact that he's whining about it right now is actually probably taking away any support that he would have had, or anyone who feels even remotely bad for him.
So this isn't a pro Charlie Baker rule?
No, absolutely not. There's not enough resources in the party. First of all, you've got candidates running for U.S. Senate. You have candidates running for every office statewide. Everyone needs to go get those signatures. And you know what they're all doing? They're organizing their people. They're hosting, you know, gatherings, asking people to go out and go get those signatures. And that's exactly what Lively should be doing if he was serious and actually wanted to contend in this race and didn't want to make an issue about the party being Charlie Baker's.
Okay. And what do you think, Jeff?
So the echo, of course, is from the last presidential election, where the Democrats actually covertly supported Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, something we only discovered after the fact. And everyone kind of points at it and saying, you know, that was wrong for the Democrats to do it. Isn't it also wrong for the Republicans to do it? Couple of points. First of all, they didn't actually scrap the rule. The rule in the Republican Party is that with a two-thirds vote, the party can give support to any particular candidate it wants, and they did get that two-thirds vote. The second is Scott Lively is completely an outlier. I mean, this is it's not only his anti-gay statements. The guy is also a Holocaust denier. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party, if I were a member of the Republican Party, I'd be doing everything I can to get away from this guy and make sure he's not part of my party, in the same way that Democrats do everything they can to make sure that, you know, people who are once part of the KKK are not part of the Democratic Party. You just don't want him around. If there is any vulnerability that Charlie Baker has this time around, it is going to be tying him to the alt-right or to the Trump administration or to folks like Scott Lively. And that's the last thing the Republicans want to do, is allow, in effect, the Republican Party be tarnished by this guy. And I think I would have done exactly what they do in this case.
Okay. Well, I think we are out of time. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Jennifer Nassours, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, currently with Rubin and Redmond. She's also founder and president of Conservative Women for a Better Future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.